Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The FAA estimates as many as 1 million people unwrapped drones at Christmas time. Maybe you've already seen them buzzing around your neighborhood. NASA and the Federal Aviation Administration are trying to figure out how those drones and more will safely navigate the skies. There are new rules, big visions, commercial and recreational. Talk of drone highways in the sky. This hour on Point, how we will live with drones. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you unwrap a new drone this Christmas? Did your neighbor, your company, what do you see coming in the skies? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Happy New Year, by the way. Welcome to 2016. Joining me now from Moffett Field, California's Paramount Copardakar. He's manager of the Safe Autonomous Systems Operations Project at NASA, where he's also principal investigator for unmanned aerial systems traffic management. That seems to be the issue of the hour. Welcome, Paramount. PK, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
And with us from Washington is Mike Whitaker, Deputy Administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration, where he's also Chief Next Gen, as in Next Generation Officer, responsible for the modernization of air traffic control to deal with all that's coming. Mike Whitaker, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me on the show, Tom.
Mike, your outfit was estimating there might be 1 million new drones, mostly recreational, as Christmas gifts, December gifts this year. What's your sense of it? Is that the pace we're on? Do you think that mark was hit?
Well, we don't have data on how many were sold. We have started registering recreational users, and we had our first day of registration just a few days before Christmas and had over 45,000 people register their drones. So we know that this is an exciting and growing industry, and our focus is really to make sure we integrate these users into our system and do it safely.
PK, you have said that you anticipate a time when every home in America will have a drone. For what?
Correct. So there are different applications of drones. You can look at commercial applications. You can look at agriculture applications. You can look at public safety application as well as personal use application. So drone in every home reflects that personal applications, such as, you know, I don't have a soccer pump today. I'm coaching soccer, and I want to send a drone and get a pump from one of my friends, things like that. But largely you will see commercial, agriculture, as well as public safety use first before we get to the personal applications.
I mean, the USA Today ran with that, Mike Whitaker in Washington, and said, you know, the challenge here is to keep the skies below 500 feet, sort of drone territory, at least so far, from turning into a demolition derby. What is the challenge there, Mike? As this population, I guess, it's expected to continue to really grow.
Well, I think when you talk about recreational users, you have people who receive a drone as a gift, for example, and they open up the box and they don't realize they've just become users of the airspace. They've just become aviators. And they have to share that airspace with all the other users. And even below 500 feet, you have, of course, landings and takeoffs at airports. You have helicopters. You have others that use that airspace. So the challenge is how you integrate these new users into that airspace, and I think for us the first step has been to increase education, and that's really been the goal over the last several weeks with registration and some of the outreach that we've been doing.
And that's where you've got this the basic rules that have come out last month of fly below 400 feet, keep the drone or unmanned aerial vehicle within visual line of sight at all times, don't fly within 5 miles of an airport. That all has a kind of a model airplane era relevance about it. PK, you're looking at a time when between recreational and commercial unmanned aerial vehicle users, we may need a more complex, and I'm sure Mike's looking at this as well, a more complex organizational strategy in the sky. It's been interpreted as drone highways in the sky. What's that referring to, PK?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we talk about drones, we really are interested in three aspects. One is national regional security. Second is safe integration into airspace. And third is getting the most economic value out of drone use at the low altitude airspace. So when you start basically taking each of these aspects, let's look at national regional security. First of all, you want to make sure that the drones accidentally or intentionally don't go to places where they shouldn't go, like White House, Wall Street, and such. So we will have to have systems in place that will protect, detect and protect these from unintentional use. Second is when we talk about safe airspace integration, what we refer to here as to making sure that all the drones operate and don't hit each other. Drones don't come in the way of the manned aviation. The drone operator has complete awareness of all the constraints in the airspace and keeps away from those constraints. Fourth, the drone give preference to the public safety drones or manned aviation. And fifth, we have authenticated operations that are allowed. So the highways, the construct of highways that you refer to, really is basically based on supply and demand. How much capacity we have in the airspace and how much demand exists for drones to operate in that airspace. So they are not fixed highways. They are more digital, virtual, flexible structures based on demand and capacity. So the big mantra here is flexibility where possible and structure such as corridors or altitude for directions or crossing restrictions only when you need it based on supply and demand.
Mike, what's the range of usage that you are all planning for, or, you know, blue skying, or maybe you're well beyond that now? I mean, what kind of population of unmanned aerial vehicles is out there now, and what do you anticipate is the range of potential? How crowded could it get up there?
Well, I think it can get very crowded, and I think as PK says, we want to create as much flexibility in the system as we can, because we can't predict exactly what the usages will be. What we do know is we've got some very promising technologies out there, what we call sense and avoid, geofencing, and other technologies that allow these aircraft to stay away from each other. So what we need to do is continue to test those technologies and work with our stakeholders toward implementing a program that allows additional operations into the system in an iterative fashion.
I mean, do you anticipate a time when the visual experience of looking up will be changed by a drone population in this country?
Well, I think the presence of these it is going to introduce a lot more users into the system, and how that looks in cities, I think, is a subject that's going to need a lot of debate and discussion. But the technology is there to allow that type of operation.
This is all lower than commercial air traffic, you know, pilot-driven air traffic, or we hear a lot of concern about these two things intersecting.
So regular aircraft operate above 500 feet, except for when they're landing or taking off, and, of course, helicopter operations and the like, emergency rescue. But the normal airplane that you think about is operating above 500 feet at all times. So that is the immediate focus, and where I think we've seen the most commercial demand for aerial photography, for firefighting support, that type of thing. So this is really focusing on that below 500 feet area.
What's the range or the ratio you're anticipating between commercial use up there? Amazon, Google, and others are pushing very hard for delivery, and they sell a lot of stuff. That would be potentially a lot of vehicles. The ratio between commercial unmanned aerial vehicles and recreational, what's the ratio you're anticipating, Mike?
Well, I don't know that we've got good statistics on the ratio between the commercial and the recreational. I think what we need to do is develop procedures and rules that allow them to coexist. And if the technologies allow these vehicles to stay away from each other and avoid collisions, that'll take us a long way toward that.
How about you, PK? Are you seeing a sharp distinction between commercial and recreational use, application, and the vehicles themselves?
There's certainly a distinction in commercial and recreational. However, that distinction is getting blurred over time because the type of capability, as Mike mentioned, on the vehicle is becoming more available as we test and conduct research, such as sense and avoid, track and locate, and ability to go all the way to the doorstep, what we refer to as last and first 50 feet. The real distinction is those who want to operate within line of sight and those who want to operate beyond visual line of sight. So as you start to test these technologies, and once we have safely proven technologies that will allow us to operate beyond visual line of sight, that's when lots of commercial uses could flourish.
Mike, is it clear that you're going to permit unmanned aerial vehicles, commercial, operating beyond line of sight? And that seems essential to Amazon's plans, for example. Are you going to give a green light for that? Have you already?
I think it's pretty clear that the technology is there to enable that. I think we have six test sites throughout the country where we test these technologies. We have partnerships with industry where we're testing these technologies. Every indication is that we will resolve the technical issues to allow this to happen. So really it becomes a question of putting in procedures in place and what technological requirements are needed to make sure you're operating safely.
I mean, we've seen Amazon, they have these huge warehouses already. Do you foresee a time soon where there are drones swarming out of portals at those warehouses with lots of individual addresses, you know, programmed in, and off goes the new pair of sneakers?
Well, I think it gets back to the fact that we need to design a system that's flexible enough so that we don't have to predict what their business model is, but we can allow safe operations and we can let the market develop the way the market wants to develop.
PK, are we on track for that now? Do we have the right strategic blueprint?
I think we are working towards that in strong collaboration with our federal partners, FAA, DHS, and such, as well as lot of industry collaboration. So the idea is to basically bring these technologies, procedures, as Mike said, and operating principles and operational requirements that are tested and demonstrate the use for beyond visual line of sight.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about dealing with the drones that now live with us, among us, above us. Talk of drone highways and more. Looking at how we'll organize, live with unmanned aerial vehicles, drones up there. Mike Whitaker is with us. He's Deputy Administrator at the Federal Aviation Administration, Chief Next Gen Officer there at the FAA, responsible for the modernization of air traffic control. And that's a big deal as this population is exploding and is expected to keep exploding. Lots of companies interested in seeing that really go at this point. Paramal Koparkdikar is with us as well. He is with NASA. NASA's paying close attention as well here, he's the head of the Safe Autonomous Systems Operations Project there, principal investigator at the Unmanned Aerial Systems Traffic Management Group there. You can join us as well in this hour. Are you following this? Are you a new drone owner? Is your neighbor? Do you know the rules of drone flight? And what about where there are no rules or they're unclear at this point? How do you see the new busy skies coming at us? Here's a little sound from Montreal in Canada. Kids got Christmas presents via drone, video posted on YouTube.
Well, what is that in the sky, guys?
Yeah, that's a helicopter with a stocking and there's presents in it.
Santa Claus is just saving money this year by employing drones instead of elves.
It's going up!
Yay! It's coming! Presents! Thank you, Santa! Thank you,
whoa, look at that, guys! All right, back up. Back up. Everyone back up.
And buzz, 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 in they come. That's kind of the homemade variety, but Amazon and others are expecting big things here. They put out a little video to demonstrate a young girl, a dog, eats her soccer cleats. They need new cleats within half an hour. How might it work? Here's Amazon. They put English broadcaster Jeremy Clarkson on the case.
After rising vertically like a helicopter to nearly 400 feet, this amazing hybrid design assumes a horizontal orientation and becomes a streamlined and fast airplane. In time, there'll be a whole family of Amazon drones, different designs for different environments. This one can fly for 15 miles.
Maybe right to your doorstep, to your window with a cup of coffee. Mike Whitaker, I guess I come back to this question of what you foresee in this drone space, which is below so far below 400 feet, Do you see corridors, or do you see a welter of flight paths up there? If it's a welter, are we all going to be hearing that drone-y sound in the skies all the time? Is that the future?
Well, I think you wouldn't necessarily have corridors. We have corridors for commercial flight, and that's been traditionally the way that we have controlled traffic. But with the new technology, things such as sense and avoid, you can have a little bit more of a flexible system that allows vehicles to stay clear of each other and operate safely. So it'll be really a combination of technology and procedures that are put together with input from stakeholders to come up with a system that is safe and lets us maintain the level of safety that we've enjoyed in recent years in our system.
I'm sure people are listening very carefully as you describe this, and we listen to that sound, those drones coming in Montreal. Think about lots more of them in the skies. Barbara, in Wakefield, Rhode Island, you're on with Mike Whitaker at the FAA and Parmal Korpar-Kadar.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. Nobody's addressing noise pollution that these drones, I assume, are going to create. What is my right to enjoy the peace and quiet in the sky above my head versus the convenience of commerce?
That's a great question, Barbara. Let's put it right to the FAA and Mike Whitaker. How about it, Mike?
Well, I think you've heard both PK and I have mentioned that this is a process that involves a lot of input from a lot of stakeholders as you design a system, because this is taking us someplace where we haven't been before. I mean, you've made the comment about looking up and seeing drones. People who live in communities are stakeholders, and we deal with this issue with respect to airport noise. People who live in towns have a voice in this debate, and I think we need to make sure we're capturing those voices as we design these systems.
But we know that Amazon and Google really want to do this. We know they have high-priced lobbyists. We know that the FAA is now coming in and informing local communities, which draft zoning laws about drones, that they're not the last word. I mean, I've seen this story we all saw out of Miami recently where they had new laws on the table, and your outfit has come in, Mike, and said, we're the boss when it comes to the skies. Where's the last word here? Is it with the local community, or is it with you in Washington?
Well, I think it's a collaborative process where we have to reach the right balance. So we have traditionally looked at this as a struggle, if you will, between innovation and safety. We don't want to slow down innovation, but we also need to make sure we're operating safely. But there are other stakeholders. We have security issues that need to be addressed. We have noise issues that need to be addressed. So all of these stakeholders have input into the process, and so we have to take all of those inputs as we build a new system.
PK, with your highways in the sky, and they may be very flexible, they may look like a welter, even if you call them highways, I guess. Does it mean that, do you expect that people are going to become as accustomed to seeing drones go over as they are to seeing birds go over today?
It's possible, and again, it's like Mike said, it's based on the need and based on the input that we receive from stakeholders, and we certainly plan to do a lot more analysis of all the issues related to acceptance, you know, noise and environmental considerations, and basically its use. So we do think that we need to consider all these aspects, technology as well as impact on the people who live underneath. So
is it going to change our experience of the skies? You're talking about big numbers coming down the pike. You're NASA. You think about what's up there a lot. If we come back in 20 years, is it just going to be a different aesthetic experience of the skies, PK?
That's certainly possible. I mean, again, you know, goes back to the point that we are making is it has to be for good use. It has to be something that society accepts. But once we get past that barrier, then I think it's possible that we may look a little bit differently in the sky. I mean, that happens today, right? I mean, 100 years ago, did anybody knew that there will be lots of aircraft over the bay of San Francisco? So now there are. So there could be situations like that that we will see in the future. But again, the burden is on us, research powerhouses, to make sure that these vehicles will operate in a safe manner in the sky. It will not be nuisance for people who live underneath or around, and people will get maximum value out of that.
It's a tall order. There's a lot of attention focused on it right now. Some big commercial interests very interested in this, and lots of amateurs with the new drones under Christmas trees and more in the last month. Parimal Kopardekar at NASA at Moffett Field in California. Thank you so much for being with us to give us a little insight today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Mike Whitaker, Deputy Administrator at the FAA. Mike, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Tom.
We're going to dive on into the law around this. There are a lot of questions out there. I can see them stacked up on my phone screen right here. With us from Seattle, Washington right now is Ryan Kalo, professor at the University of Washington School of Law, faculty co-director on the Tech Policy Lab, focuses on improving tech policy there, researches the intersection of law and emerging technologies, and is thinking a lot about drones. Ryan Kalo, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Is the law clear on how this is all going to work and what my rights are as a property owner? I mean, I'm looking back at reports that say there was a time when my rights were understood to be, if I'm standing on my property, then my rights went from a heaven above to hell below. But that doesn't seem to be the case today.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, a caller had raised the issue of nuisance, which is the idea that the drones would be very loud. But there's also the idea that your privacy might be violated and even that your property rights might be violated. I mean, if you have drones flying over your house in an area that you could reasonably use, then you might have a trespass issue under common law. So there's not just the regulatory infrastructure we're talking about. There's also sorting out what individual rights might be here.
I want to get right to very straightforward questions for you, Ryan. I've got plenty. So do the listeners here. Pete in Mason City, Iowa. Pete, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I want to know what's going to happen if I see a drone lurking above my personal property, and I don't know whether it's commercial interest or whether it's a personal person down the street operating a drone that's maybe outfitted with a GoPro camera.
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to legally be able to shoot that thing down, like with a hose or swat at it or, you know, or use a crossbow or something like that? What's going to happen legally to me, or, you know, if it's an invasion of privacy?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. Ryan, this comes up again and again. It's many people, it's their first response when they see one over their property. Grab the shotgun, Martha. What's the law?
I've never seen as much creativity as I've heard of people taking drones out of the sky. Crossbow's a new one to me. So, I mean, the short answer is that, you know, you have a couple, your first and best course of action is going to be to call the police. Right. If you do decide to take a drone out in your airspace, you run into some risks. One risk is that although you could sue the person for trespass, they could sue you for damaging their property, and you sue each other. And that would be this idea of trespass to chattels, or if it's completely destroyed, what's called conversion. There's also the prospect of criminal charges. Now, very interestingly, a court down south, I think it was in, gosh, but I don't remember exactly where, but a court down south actually acquitted somebody who shot a drone out of the sky because he said it was spying on his daughter sunbathing.
I'm looking at that already. That was Bullitt County, yeah. Kentucky, William Meredith.
There you go.
And he took a shotgun out, shot it down. And, of course, a few minutes later, the owners of the drone showed up. Things got pretty tense. In the end, the judge cleared him of all charges, said the drone had invaded his privacy, the judge telling the local news outlet there that he had the right to shoot this drone.
And that's a new thing. That's anomalous. And also, you know, it didn't play out that way in a similar circumstance in New Jersey. As far as I know, that is like one of the first instances of people being able to take physical action to prevent a privacy violation. I mean, can you imagine taking somebody's camera and smashing it on the ground and not getting in trouble, or going to, you know, the servers of a company you think is violating your privacy and destroying them? You know, that's not usually how the law operates. So this is interesting and anomalous.
And yet you hear that response again and again. What do you think it is about drones and GoPro cameras and all the rest that elicits such a visceral response from so many citizens, Ryan?
Well, I wrote about this a few years ago. I mean, you know, it's the idea is that often when your privacy is being violated in the United States, it's really hard to picture, right? Because it's happening online. It's happening, you know, in some way that you're not aware. But, you know, these drones are these flying, inscrutable robots that are in the air, and they have cameras. And I think it elicits a really visceral response. And I think that, you know, people's reactions, the reactions of state legislatures, the slowness with which the FAA is pursuing this, and indeed this acquittal in Kentucky, are all evidence of that effect that drones have on us that's rather unique.
You know, we had the NASA representative and the FAA representative, and you can hear them being sort of diplomatic and careful. But I think people are trying to visualize where we're headed here? Because the numbers being thrown around are big. And you can see Amazon and others really just chomping at the bit to get these out there doing delivery where they're not stuck in traffic. They're coming right to your doorstep or even delivering coffee to your windowsill on the, you know, sixth floor of your apartment building. What kind of drone population do you see as possible, Ryan? And is the law ready?
Well, let me just say, I think we're really, really far away from the scenarios that you described. And I was a little surprised about the way that particularly the FAA was talking about this. I mean, just the idea of sense and avoid, the idea that drones would be able to avoid each other, mm-hmm. that technology is not fully baked. And then also, if you're thinking about delivering something to someone's house, if you're Amazon, you really need that drone to be able to fly by itself. If you think about it, you know, a way that the FAA seems to currently contemplate this, at least according to guidance that they issued, the idea would be that you'd have a person watching the drone and flying it the way you or I would to its location. But if you're going to do that, you might as well put that person on a bicycle and ride it over, right? What you really need are these highways where these drones can navigate by themselves. My understanding
of technology. And you punch in an address and it sort of goes up with the GPS
exactly.
and off it goes. Truly unmanned.
They're working on that, and that's part of what the NASA Ames effort is about, is showing how that might function. But the other issue is regulatory. I mean, you know, the FAA was told by Congress that they needed to have a comprehensive plan for, you know, private use of drones by September 30, 2015, and that they had to have a final rule December 14, 2015. We're not anywhere close to a final rule. The final rule has to go through a kind of stakeholder vetting where lots of people comment on it. So we're already delayed. I don't agree that we've solved the sense and avoid problems. I don't think the tech is there. And I don't know anybody, you know, that thinks it's there already. There's also trivial issues like energy. How do you get a drone that can carry a package to have enough energy to go from point A to point B? So I think that we're not there from a regulatory standpoint, and we're also not there from the sense of technology. Now, some of the things people want to do, like take, you know, photos of crops to make sure that, you know, agriculture or you know, to take photographs of property for real estate, you know, all those things are happening already. They're there. We certainly know how to do that. But the idea that we're going to be able to do, you know, drone delivery really soon, that strikes me as unlikely.
I mean, so is this all a fever dream? Here you've got the top guy at NASA who we just had here saying within 5 to 10 years, every house would have a drone. And I don't think he's talking just to take GoPro pictures of snow on the roof.
Well, you know, listen, you know, PK, I know he's a serious engineer, and I've heard estimates like that before. But you remember, you know, a bunch of years ago, 2007, mm-hmm. Bill Gates, who, you know, knows something about technology, said we'd have a robot in every home within a few years,
yeah.
right? And at what level perhaps we do. We have things that you might think of as robots, and robots is an exploding field. I mean, it's just unbelievable how fast it's growing
right
now.
Which is quite related to this whole drone question.
Well, I think that the issues with drones are issues with robots more generally, and I think mm-hmm. the more that especially government realizes that, the better off we'll be. I mean, you know, the truth is that the kinds of issues you have to solve with having a bunch of drones fly around by themselves in the air is not so different from the kind of issues you have to solve with having a bunch of cars on the ground driving around themselves. And in each case, you have privacy issues and so forth. And so I'd really like to see agencies talk more to one another. And right now, my understanding is that the, you know, FAA is talking to a part of NASA, and I think that's a great beginning. You know, but I wonder whether NASA can really help us with every single issue involving robots going forward.
Presumably, they're thinking at a high level about what it means to have one day sort of autonomous vehicles in significant populations, if PK is right, up in the sky. I mean, at the high level, that sounds like NASA-worthy challenge.
Well, that's right. I mean, so, you know, if you think about it for a moment, a few years ago, we had this question of whether Toyotas were suddenly accelerating. I'm not sure we ever got total resolution on that. But there were folks who were worried that it was a software glitch and not mechanical or error. They had to call in NASA to answer that question. And NASA can do that. It can take a break and look at a Toyota, but it can't do it for everything.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about drones, living with drones, big population out there already, and expected to grow rapidly in the years to come. There's a lot that's unclear at this point about how it's all going to work, but you can hear all the thought going into it. Ryan Kahlo joins us from Seattle, Washington, the University of Washington School of Law. He's paying close attention. You can join us, too. What do you think? Are we going to need drone highways in the sky to deal with the traffic up there? Airline pilots, what are you seeing? What about close to home? What if a drone buzzes your barbecue or drops your delivery or peeps in your window? Do you want a sky full of drones? Do you want your own? Just look into the news clips on this, and you can see there's a lot of hunger to have delivery going on here, driving a lot of this. Google posted this video last year talking about Project Wing, its project for home delivery of products by drone.
Throughout history, there have been a series of innovations that have each taken a huge chunk out of the friction of moving things around. Project Wing aspires to take another big chunk of the remaining friction out of moving things around in the world.
A huge chunk out of the friction of moving things around. Just don't take a chunk out of the roof of my house. I mean, there's all kinds of dystopian views of this, too. There's an ad out there for a new Audi, the A6. Harkens back to Hitchcock's movie, The Birds. There's a business building surrounded by evil drones. People are panicking, but one businessman calmly takes off in his Audi.
Google search, Bodega Beach House.
And the dystopia is not just in ads. Here's that moment. You may have seen it. This was during a World Cup slalom ski race just a week ago. Austrian Olympic silver medalist Marcel Hirscher was almost hit by a drone carrying a big TV camera for a broadcast crew. It came down with a big crash right behind him, just a milliseconds behind him. Here he is after the race. The skier almost taken out. He says in German, it's a total outrage. That kind of thing can happen, but it really shouldn't. And of course, everybody hopes it won't. Ryan Kahlo, stand by in Seattle. Kyle is on the phone from Boston. Hi, Kyle. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm an air traffic controller at a very large radar facility in New England. And I just wanted to share a very quick story. A couple months ago, one of the local approach controls at a busy airport closed, and they handed the airspace over to us. And as part of that relief briefing, they notified us that for the last 2 hours, there was a drone that had been hovering in vicinity of one of the runways. And they told us that the state police for that state were out monitoring the drone, but they felt that there was nothing that they could do to reasonably protect the airplane from the drone. So we ended up having to just tell the pilots, hey, you're cleared for the approach, but be advised, there's a drone hovering near the airport. We don't know where it's going. We're not talking to it, and the state police are watching it. So I think we need to acknowledge that even though we might be able to regulate drones within the commercial sector, the private sector, so the people that are just getting drones in their home, think about all the people that live within close proximity to airports, we can never realistically manage all of these drones, and it presents a very, very large hazard to aviation safety, which myself and my colleagues are very, very concerned about.
So, Kyle, you're an air traffic controller. Do you see this as a remote question some years down the road, no big deal now, or already urgent?
We're too late, Tom. This is already happening. It's already here. We're too late. We're behind the power curve with regard to how do we manage drones and keep them safely separated from the 767s and the 737s that are trying to land at the airport. There's no reasonable way that we can modify the software or control all of these drones, especially the third-party aftermarket drones that are coming from maybe China or Asia that people are buying and getting under their Christmas tree.
And these are not small. I mean, these are up to 55 pounds or something by that, these recreational vehicles. Kyle, I appreciate your call. Ryan Kahlo, if there's a pyramid of concerns, this must be right near the top, the interaction with commercial aviation, passenger aviation. How about the law and this zone? You hear our air traffic controller very without confidence that this is under control.
Right. Well, I mean, so first of all, let me just say it's already unlawful under FAA rules to fly so close to a airport, right? And so we're not talking necessarily about making it lawful or unlawful. It's unlawful. But then you have other techniques you want to bring to bear. Technology like geofencing, which is the idea that the drone literally would not be able to fly near the airport. Education, just telling people that this is a serious issue, whether on, you know, at the airport or when they buy the drone or in other times. And then, you know, the FAA has just required folks to register their drones. you know, between a very small, you know, half a pound up to, as you say, about 55 pounds, so that if anything did go wrong, at least we'd sort of, the idea would be know who was responsible for it. And, you know, these are just a bunch of distant tactics that we're trying to use to domesticate the problem, which is, you know, a very serious one. By the way, we also need to test whether what would the impact be. I mean, if a small drone runs into a jet, is that really going to take the jet down? I think that's something that folks are actively looking into, and that's appropriate.
I mean, you know, we've seen flocks of birds give trouble to jets. A 55-pound chunk of plastic and metal, I guess it all depends where it hits. This geofencing you're talking about, that I guess would require software in the manufacture of the drones that was responsive to electronic signals. Are the manufacturers required to install whatever the governing authorities want in these drones at this point?
They're not. I mean, so what happened, it was an interesting issue. What happened when a drone manufactured by a Chinese manufacturer landed in the White House lawn, that manufacturer responded by geofencing all of D.C., basically saying, you know, it wouldn't work there. And it caused a lot of problems with the operating software, and they had to roll that back.
Why were there problems? I mean, is it because somebody couldn't play with one at a park in D.C.? Who cares?
Well, I mean, you know, my understanding is that the problems like with the hasty update hurt the drones that were not just in D.C., mm-hmm. right? But then you have to ask yourself, you know, there may be times when you want to be able to use a drone appropriately, you know, in airspace, you know, near an airport. For instance, let's say that you have a bunch of birds that are hanging out on the tarmac and you want to get rid of them before, yep. so that they don't get scared. And you use a drone to do that, right? So the problem with things like geofencing done, you know, in the hardware itself, in the firmware and the software, is that you won't be able to do anything with it. And it could cause a lot of harm. So I'm not sure that I think that's the right move, but it's one of the options that regulators have available.
What about some kind of override? I mean, you heard of the air traffic controller there saying the state police were watching this zone near a big airport, I guess. But there's nothing they could do about it. I'm reading here in Chicago, they've now prohibited drones above schools and libraries, churches, private property without permission. In Miami, they've banned drones within a half-mile radius of a large public event. I don't know how they define that exactly, but we get it. And police are able to use jamming technologies to take them down. But if you jam it and it just drops, that sounds pretty dangerous too.
Well, there's two kinds of dangers there, Tom, in my opinion. One of them is the danger of if you don't do it responsibly, it will hurt somebody. The second one is just that if you give the police the power to take drones down under certain circumstances, you worry about how police and others will use them under other circumstances. For example, if there's a massive protest, yeah. or if, you know, we're trying to the news is trying to cover an event. And you remember there were no fly zones over Ferguson. And so I've heard reports of police jamming cell phones during police encounters.
Yeah.
And, you know, you worry about that. So I don't, again, whenever you have a technological solution that's baked right in, you worry about the scenarios that the regulators didn't foresee. And so I tend to think better enforcement and better education is probably the place to start.
Terry in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Terry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, my son, the first day after Christmas, took his drone out. Very expensive, $1,500 3DR drone.
Oh, okay.
Supposed to be one of the safest ones to use. And it malfunctioned. He didn't do anything funny. It completely fell. I'm wondering, is there going to be an insurance if it would have fallen on a car or a person?
You mean it fell out of the sky, Terry? It didn't just fail to take off. It fell down from the sky.
Yeah, it was working wonderfully. He had a great flight. He was probably 200 feet in the air moving around. And it literally, all of a sudden, like one of the motors just stopped working. It flipped over upside down and fell straight to the ground and smashed into a bunch of pieces. And it was brand new.
Thank heavens nobody was hurt. Did you check? Do you have any kind of insurance at the moment that would cover that, Terry? Do you even know?
No, I have no idea. My ex-wife bought it for him. I'm not worried. I mean, one, I am worried. Sure, I want him to get it replaced and fixed by the company. But I was worried if it would have hit a car or
a
person.
Or
I mean,
person.
It's insuring that person.
Ryan, what about it? Is there standard coverage in home insurance policies or something else that might have covered that? Or is Terry flying kind of naked there?
Well, you have to check your own you know, policy for your house. You know, the truth is that, first of all, if there's a malfunction, you want to go to the manufacturer, right? And I think liability there will be pretty clear. And
if it fails and falls on, let's say, a car and does, you know, $10,000 worth of damage, you think the Chinese manufacturer is going to cut a check?
Well, I mean, look, these manufacturers are huge, sophisticated, you know, international companies with doing a lot of business in the U.S. So, yes, I think if one of their products messes up, then they will write a check. But, you know, it's going to be hard to show. It's going to be hard to show that, you know, it really was the way that the thing was built as opposed to the way that someone was flying it. By the way, this will only get more complicated. So imagine if it's, instead of you're just flying the thing the way that it comes, you know, to you from the factory, you're actually running apps like the way you have on your phone that make the drone do special different things. And you downloaded that app from just some random website, from some app store.
Like there are apps out there now where you can put your drone up and have it just follow you. I guess it's tracking your cell phone and it would just buzz along 300 feet above you wherever you go.
Sure, just like that, Tom. And so, like all these different apps that are, you know, that make our cell phones and mobile phones so wonderful, you know, those same apps also introduce the possibility of even greater failure modes. And so then how do you unpack that liability? How do you figure out who to sue when you have some follow me app or dive bomb so-and-so app or facial, whatever you happen to have? How do you figure out who's responsible? And right now we're not confronted with that so sharply because most of these things are just teleoperated by individuals. But as it becomes more sophisticated, liability is going to be harder and harder. Now,
I think I heard you go quickly over something interesting there. Dive bomb so-and-so, facial, you said like facial recognition. So as a prank or something worse, I could program a drone to go after somebody, show them their face and say, if you see them, I don't know, prank them or worse.
Sure. I mean, you know, the thing we figured out with apps is that it's only limited by, you know, the imagination of some teenager in a basement or some huge company, right? And so you could imagine an app, for instance, that, as a joke, flew around, had facial recognition, found your friend, and when they found your friend, they flew at your friend, mm-hmm. and then, you know, pulled up at the last minute, supposedly, and that would malfunction actually hurt the person, right?
Yeah.
What do you do? I mean, do you go after the individual who uploaded that app? Do you go after the app manufacturer? Do you go after the manufacturer of the platform, the drone itself? It isn't clear.
Michael in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Michael, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. Two things. First of all, following the current train of thought, it sounds like anyone who owns a drone should have to have liability insurance, and states or the federal government should define the limit of that. But more importantly, I'm thinking about security questions. So you have no-fly zones, the White House, the Capitol, et cetera, but you also have large public events that are periodic.
Sure.
So we just finished New Year's Eve at Times Square. We're coming up on the Super Bowl. There are all the playoff games that are happening. Okay, those are large enterprises. Maybe they could work with officials to do geofencing around those facilities. But then you move to smaller outdoor, say, art fairs. The Ann Arbor Street Fair is huge, has 2,000 exhibitors in the middle of July. And as you move to more and more smaller situation, it's going to be harder and harder, number one, for the promoters to cover all those bases, and number two, I wonder if the people who have the authority to set up geofencing perimeters would be able to accommodate all the requests.
Michael, let me ask you, do you feel paranoid raising that kind of concern or credibly concerned? Michael.
Do I feel paranoid?
Yeah.
Well, look, the whole country is paranoid right now after San Bernardino. But think about it. You don't even have to be on site. You no longer, with a drone, you wouldn't have to be on a suicide mission.
Yeah. Yeah.
It changes now. It changes the game back to I can do a lot of bad stuff and get away scot-free.
Michael, I appreciate your call. Our time is short. Ryan, how about this security front?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that police at the federal and local level will need to be trained on how to deal with, with drones at big events, for sure. I mean, I don't know that drones are going to be quite as nefarious as some folks believe. Not to dispute Mike's ideas, but, you know, you could throw a grenade, you could throw, you know, a football full of C4. I mean, what has to be illegal is the underlying weapon, and the drone itself is just a vehicle for that, among many. But sure, I mean, it's not just that, but it's also just the sheer safety issues associated with having so many drones at over the art fair in Ann Arbor, for instance.
Do you see inevitability here? And is this conversation like people sitting around in, I don't know, 1910, you know, where they're used to horse and buggy and they're worried that there'll be cars all over the place? And in fact, cars came to be all over the place. And in fact, they killed a lot of people. And but everybody just came to accept it. Is that where we're headed with drones?
There are some stories that suggest that, you know, we're all worried about cars, and many of the concerns that we had came to fruition. They destroyed public transportation. They polluted. They hurt people. Others would say that that's just nonsense, and they've done much more good. You can say the same story.
Oh, both
about
are clearly true. Yeah.
One of my favorite examples, though, is with the elevator and all the fights that happened with whether or not the elevator could be operated by itself and all the arguments that were deployed. Those are really interesting to look to as well.
That might be a more compelling parallel if elevators could fly right out of the shaft and go just about anywhere.
Charlie and Chocolate Factory, yeah.
Let's hope not. Ryan Kahler with the University of Washington School of Law, we hope you'll stay all over this, and we hope you'll come back and talk with us as this world of drones continues to grow and grow. Thank you very much for being with us today, Ryan.
Thanks, Tom.
And listeners, it's great to be back with you in 2016. Look forward to a lot of great conversations in the year ahead. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.